This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. In September of 1994, America's children met one of the most iconic animated school teachers of all time, Miss Valerie Felicity Frizzle. Miss Frizzle, for short. It's been 25 years since PBS debuted The Magic School Bus. The show introduced millions of children to a world where science and their imagination collided inside a very special yellow bus. Miss Frizzle's cultural impact endures today. We got a lot of stories from you who were impacted by this show, including this one that landed in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Evita. I'm from Paducah, Kentucky, and this is a shout out to The Magic School Bus. I loved that show as a child. Miss Frizzle was funny and enlightening, and I really loved that she let the kids discover and learn independently on their own. And I also absolutely adored her themed dresses for each lesson. I haven't gotten to that point as a teacher yet, but it's in the works. So, yeah, Magic School Bus was life-altering in the best of ways. Cartoons rule.
Now, TV has had plenty of science shows. 3-2-1 Contact, Mr. Wizard's World, Beakman's World, and Bill Nye the Science Guy. But The Magic School Bus was different. A book series adapted for cartoons and video games and a classroom curriculum. Joining us in studio is Sandy Welch, the program director for the National Science Foundation. The foundation helps fund the show's production. Sandy, welcome to 1A.
Thanks.
Also with us is Linda Semensky, the head of content at PBS Kids. Linda, welcome.
Great to be here.
Linda Semensky, let me start with you. Since there are probably not too many 2 to 8-year-olds in our audience right now, we're working on that demographic. Can you just give us the basic story of what the Magic School Bus is about?
Well, we don't run the Magic School Bus on PBS anymore, but the basic idea was that kids got to go on adventures, usually through some form of science, on the school bus, and frequently it was as they were, you know, figuring something out or solving a problem. I will confess, at the time when Magic School Bus came along, I was not at PBS. I was working at Nickelodeon at the time on the Nicktoons, and usually I didn't pay a lot of attention to what else was being made out there. You know, we were very focused, but I remember when Magic School Bus came along because I was a little bit jealous of it. Yvette Kaplan was the designer of the show. She was working on Doug at the time for Nick, and she went off to work on Magic School Bus, and she's fantastic, and I remember thinking, oh man, and she did an amazing job because the look of the show was so great, and that's what I was looking at.
First of all, when you mentioned Nicktoons, you immediately like, oh my God, because I'm a child of the 90s and I grew up with all of those cartoons. But what was it about Magic School Bus that made you kind of envious at the time? What did you see in the show then?
Well, it was the first academic show I could think of in a pretty long time that had a sense of humor. And I thought that was great because I felt that, you know, those early years of PBS, everything had a sense of humor. And slowly, I thought that, you know, things had become a little more earnest and a little younger skewing. And Magic School Bus skewed older. It was funny. It looked great. Those dresses were amazing, just like in the books. And it did a really good job of turning those books into a really great show. And, you know, it was a narrative. It was a narrative that featured science, and I thought that was great.
Now, Linda, zooming out just a little bit from Magic School Bus, just to talk a little more broadly about PBS Kids, because one of the core challenges, it seems, with this kind of show or any show, and that also kind of makes Magic School Bus so remarkable that it did all these things well, is you've got a bunch of different constituencies to deal with. You've got children, you've got parents, you've got community institutions, you've got teachers, you've got station managers. So you kind of have to find something that works in different ways for everybody.
Well, that's true. It's true. But if you look for shows that tell stories, have great characters, have a sense of humor where that's appropriate, and really work the curriculum in as part of the story, not just, you know, in the show, but as part of the story where perhaps a character is interested in that topic or kids are solving a problem that requires you to figure something out, it actually works pretty well. Science is a really good topic for narratives because if you're solving a problem or figuring something out, it works as a story. so it works really well in stories.
We heard from a super fan of Magic School Bus who shared how the TV series shaped her academic and her professional future. Here's what Alex left in our inbox.
My name is Alex Peterson. I'm currently working on my PhD in biochemistry at the University of Maryland. I heard you guys were looking for people to talk about the impact of Magic School Bus and other programs like it on people's lives and careers in STEM, and I thought, I'm the perfect candidate. I watched pretty much every single episode of Magic School Bus when I was little, and I think I collected every single book, and I directly credit it to my career today. My favorite episode was the one, It Takes the Cake, where they explore the chemistry of baking. And I even credited Magic School Bus in my college admissions essay and my grad school admissions essay as being directly responsible for making me fall in love with science. I'm hoping that my collection of books and movies will allow my little cousins to have the same sort of inspiration, and one now even wants to become a surgeon. So yeah, big thanks to Magic School Bus, who definitely got me where I am today.
Sandy, Magic School Bus is certainly not the first program to try to impart science to kids. There have been many, many others, you know, 3-2-1 Contact, Bill Nye the Science Guy, Mr. Wizard's World, Beekman's World, all of which I inhaled as a little kid. But talk about what set the Magic School Bus apart from your perspective, particularly when it became clear that this show caught on, when it was a hit.
Well, at NSF, our focus, of course, from the beginning was on what impact on kids' learning. And you've just had a caller to talk about the impact on her life. I mean, which is amazing to hear a story like that. But I think from the beginning at PBS, and then I did not know about NSF and who was funding at that time, but later, you know, I certainly did. I think it was just understanding that this was, and Linda said it well, it was a really engaging character, a situation kids could relate to, being in a classroom, taking a field trip. But what was amazing was Mrs. Frizzle. I mean, she was a teacher everybody wished they had. And she was doing things with the kids that, you know, were just so exciting and so much fun. So it was so different in many ways. And then the producers started this idea of what if we went into science museums with exhibits? What if we went into after-school programs? They were so creative and involving of the stations and the local community and teachers that I think from the beginning, I was very convinced it was going to be a major hit and have a major impact.
Now, Lily Tomlin originated the role of Miss Frizzle in 1994. Here she is in an interview in 2015 with Kelly Ripa and Michael Strahan talking about playing Miss Frizzle.
Miss Frizzle is very eccentric, and the kids love her, and she can change the Magic School Bus into, she can go into your body, you know, go, she can become very tiny.
It's a classic
episode.
The bus
can get really tiny and go through your bloodstream, can get go into the cosmos. It does everything. And kids never believe I'm Miss Frizzle because she kind of looks like Bette Midler.
She does look like Bette Midler.
She's got red hair flop, you know, and she's just vivacious. And in fact, kids in our family, when they're really little, and I was doing Miss Frizzle years ago, it would be on the television, and they'd look at me so suspicious. They'd look at the TV, and they'd look at me.
Yeah.
And then Miss Frizzle would say something. She would say, like, you know, to the bus or buckle up or something. They'd say, okay, now you say it.
Now, Lily Tomlin reprised that role in the Netflix reboot, The Magic School Bus Rides Again, but a lot had changed in her professional life since we last saw her.
Miss Frizzle?
Hey, Val.
Whoa, total Frizzle overload. Actually, you can now call me Professor Frizzle, PhD. The first of many changes this year.
Changes?
Class, please welcome your new science teacher and my little sister, Miss Fiona Felicity Frizzle.
What?
What?
This can't be happening.
Now.
Big changes in the world of the Magic School Bus and changes in the way that we teach science to children through the media. We'll discuss that more as we continue with Sandy Welch of the National Science Foundation and Linda Semensky of PBS Kids. We'll get to some more of your questions and thoughts as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're riding along with 1A from WAMU and NPR.
You might get baked into a pile on the Magic School Bus. Support for NPR and the following message come from CarMax. For more than 25 years, CarMax has made it easy to sell your car. They provide free appraisals and offers on the spot. CarMax will buy your car even if you don't buy theirs. In fact, CarMax has bought more than 8 million vehicles. To learn more and schedule your free appraisal, visit CarMax.com.
Maybe you're up with the sun, or maybe you're, well, not a morning person. Either way, you can hear Morning Edition from NPR News on your schedule. It's on demand, weekdays 7 to 3. Just say, Alexa, play Morning Edition.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're talking about science programming on television for kids, especially the series The Magic School Bus, which ran on PBS and now has a new series, The Magic School Bus Rides Again, on Netflix. We're speaking with Sandy Welch, program director for the National Science Foundation, and Linda Semensky, head of content at PBS Kids. We asked you to tell us which TV shows or other kids' media inspired your career choices. We got an overwhelming response. Here are just a few of the messages that landed in our inbox.
This is Nick Mater. I'm from Stuart, Florida. And Flipper was the TV show that inspired me to become a dolphin trainer back in the late 80s.
My name is Dawn, and I'm from Clearwater. My childhood show that I loved was Bewitched. And besides being in love with Elizabeth Montgomery, I also loved Darren's job working in advertising. And that's what I do for a living. I've been doing it for almost 10 years.
My name is Kevin. I live in Snowville, New Hampshire. Believe it or not, it was the Bob Newhart show. I love the show so much that I became an innkeeper in 1987 and have been doing it for the past 24 years.
Hey, this is Jeff in Bay Harbor Islands. And growing up, my favorite movie was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So I ended up being a pastry chef.
Those are all very cool. I have to say that when the caller mentioned Bewitched, I was like, this could go a number of ways. Sandy, you worked as an elementary school librarian and in programming at PBS, as you mentioned, before joining the National Science Foundation. What is it about science, Sandy, that turns kids on so much?
You know, that's a good question, Joshua. I just think that it is... just excite. It's mysterious sometimes to kids, but it's exciting. Let me give you an example. I have a grandson. He's now 9, but when he was 3 years old, I was with him. He was playing in the backyard. It was a sunny day. He looked up in the sky. He said, "Grandson," he calls me grandson, "did you know that the earth revolves around the sun?" He's 3 years old. I said, "Well, yes, I did know that. How did you know that? Did you read that in a book or did you see?" "I just know these things."
Just wise beyond his years.
But he's 3. So, you know, when you say, what is it about science? I think at an early age, kids are observing things like that. And they start to question, is this possible? What is that I'm looking at? So... again, there are just so many things. The oceans, volcanoes, dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs, for sure.
Oh, it just somehow, they're so intrigued by those things.
We recently did a piece about the new dinosaur exhibit at the National Museum of Natural History here in Washington called Deep Time, which is amazing. I am a grown man. I'm almost 40 years old. The minute that I saw that, I was 13 years old again. It was like walking into Jurassic Park. It's kind of endlessly fascinating. And Linda, that's one of the things that I think is also interesting about what happens on PBS is you're not just depicting the science or the teachers. You also have to depict the kids themselves as being capable of loving science. There's a program called Sid the Science Kid, which debuted on PBS Kids back in 2008. Here's a quick clip.
"Hi, I'm Sid.
And I am Gabriella. Our team built a new invention.
Yeah, it's a new way for me to tell a joke using my favorite simple machine. We call it the Super Duper Microphone Getter Clever Joke Teller.
Here's our hypothesis."
That's a clip of Sid the Science Kid, which debuted on PBS Kids in 2008. Linda, you helped develop the program. What did you want to express to kids about science?
Well, the main thing I was looking for at the time was, what would it be like if a perfectly normal kid loved science? Because so many depictions of fans of science on TV up till that point had been nerdy kids, basically. And I felt like that probably wasn't a good thing for science. And I had worked on Dexter's Lab, a show that I loved working on, and I loved Dexter, but Dexter was basically a nerdy kid who was, you know, loved science but was socially inept. And he really wasn't a walking billboard for working in science.
Well, and he was also working on fantastical. If I mix these chemicals together, I can power my rocket and travel across the dimension. Right. Like, it wasn't real science.
Right. And it was a really fun show to work on. But I started thinking, well, you know, what would it be like if a really normal kid just loved science? How could we role model just, you know, the love of science for kids? And we, you know, we always look at PBS Kids as a guide to how the world works for very curious kids. And we want to role model what it's like to be curious, to be interested, what it's like to ask questions about something that you're really interested in. And when we were meeting with the Jim Henson Company, we were talking with Lisa Henson and Hallie Stanford, and we were just talking about, you know, they had an idea for a show about a kid who was kind of a stand-up comedian. And we said, and what if he really liked science? And they just took that and ran with it, and that's how Sid became Sid.
Sandy, talk about some of the criteria that the National Science Foundation considers in terms of what projects to support. Are there certain goals, priorities that rise to the top of the list, certain key factors to consider?
We certainly look for projects that have a very clear educational mission and rationale in terms of what kind of impact do they want to have on the kids. Let me also point out that for every project NSF funds, we insist that they have a team of people who have expertise in child psychology, cognitive development, as well as the science content, and, of course, strong creative production skills. But they also have to have evaluators and researchers working hand in hand with producers, really finding out what impacts are you really having, and measuring that using very clear scientific methods. So we are always looking at, did a show increase a child's interest in science? Did the kid start to ask questions or want to talk about it? Or like the kids I talked about, go to the library, want to read more about it. Now they want to go on the internet to read more about it. Does it change attitudes in any way? For example, we know that girls sometimes, physics, chemistry, I don't want to go there. Can we, through the media, somehow start to change attitudes? And then there's engagement. What kind of engagement? Is it sustained over time? Will they keep coming back and looking at a program, or will they continue their interest in getting involved in some activities, experiments of some sort?
So you want measurable progress.
We want measurable indications that there was really impact. NSF has a very well-defined review process. It's known as the gold standard amongst federal agencies, because this is all federal money. And by the way, Joshua, we invest a lot in these children's programs. In any given year, we may make an investment of $10 to $15 million. So we want to make sure that those investments are really having impact with children.
And I'm glad you mentioned that it is a federal agency. Could you just explain what the National Science Foundation is? I think we've heard of it, but we may not know quite what it is.
Sure. It was created by an act of Congress in 1950. Our primary mission is to fund scientists and other researchers, engineers, mathematicians in doing basic scientific research. That's one big part. The other big part is education, educating the public about the scientific discoveries and impacts. So since 1950, that's been our mission. Where Congress appropriates funds, and now it's about $8 billion a year. It's a major undertaking, and it's fueling much of the scientific development in our country.
We heard from a teacher who still uses the original series in her classroom. Here's what Brittany left in the inbox.
This is Brittany calling from Washington, D.C. I am a teacher at Arlington Science Focus Elementary School in Arlington, Virginia, and we have a very strong STEM and science program at our school. So we still show our kids at school the Magic School Bus videos, and they love them. I used to watch them when I was a kid a long time ago. Now you can stream them on YouTube, which is great. You don't have to put the VHS tape in to watch them, but they're still very relevant to science learning today, and they still sort of inspire our students in the way that I felt inspired to learn about the world around them, to learn about animals, weather, that kind of thing.
Yeah, Brittany, thank you for calling in and sharing your thoughts. And Linda, that gets to something else I wanted to ask you about, which has to do with interactive content. You know, we've come a ways from the days that you got like a CD-ROM, CD-ROM games, which seem quaint now. You mean a computer program was on a physical thing? Now it's interactive content that's on a phone in a kid's pocket or maybe an iPad in a kid's hands. How does that change PBS's strategy for building these kinds of programs?
Well, the strategy at PBS for a while now has been to look at the program, the digital content, and any other platforms all at the same time. So it's not like a show is created and then they go off and figure out what they can do with it. What happens is, you know, at the same time a show is being worked on and a team is thinking about, well, how would this look on the web? What kinds of apps can we do with this? What kinds of games can we make that would reinforce the learning from the different episodes? So sometimes you'll have an episode about a particular topic and then a game about that and possibly even an app focusing on that and several other stories as well. So the idea being that you will watch the show, you can play the games that would reinforce the content that you're being taught, and then you will hopefully be so interested that there will be, you know, ideas on the web or in social media about the show where you can, parents can sit down with their kids or teachers can take their students and do one of those experiments that matches up with the game and the show.
We'll continue in just a moment with Sandy Welch of the National Science Foundation and PBS Kids Head of Content, Linda Semensky. And after the break, we'll be joined by the creator of a new kind of science program. Remember Jib Jab, those goofy videos on the web? You'll be surprised what they're doing now. Stay close.
Support for 1A and the following message come from American Express. You've got big ideas for your business, but figuring out how to make them happen can be a real challenge. Well, the answer may be as simple as American Express Financing Solutions. They have over 4,000 specialists who can help find the right solution for your business. Chat with them today to see if you're eligible so you can get your plans up and running. The powerful backing of American Express. Don't do business without it. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/business.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
Malcolm Gladwell is one of the most well-known thinkers in the world. But he says a lot of his fans don't know that he's black.
White people don't know. Black people always know.
How do you feel about that?
I find it hilarious, first of all.
Malcolm Gladwell on race, pop culture, and a whole lot more. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Back now to our conversation with Linda Semensky and Sandy Welch. Let's add one more voice to the conversation. Joining us now is Evan Spiridellis. He is the co-founder, along with his brother Greg, of the online entertainment studio Jib Jab. He's also the co-creator of Storybots, a popular children's educational media franchise that's available on YouTube and Netflix. Evan, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us about Storybots. What's it about?
Well, Storybots is about making really great, fun stuff for kids and their parents. And, you know, Greg and I, my brother and I, started Jib Jab in 1999, focused on creating content online. And along the way, we wound up having five kids between the two of us. And we started looking at the content that was out there for them and thinking about what kind of stuff we wanted them to see. And we said, hey, we could do this. We should give this a shot. So we came up with StoryBots.
This is a long way from the early days of Jib Jab, where you were doing these kind of like satires with famous people as kind of online marionettes singing parody songs. You've kind of come a long way.
Yeah, the political satires was at the beginning of our career, and then we really started to, once we had kids, this was really where our passion was, and creating stuff for kids that made them inquisitive about the world and made learning fun, and most importantly for us, as parents, making shows that are as entertaining to parents as they are to kids.
Let me play a quick clip from StoryBots. This is the Triceratops song, and then you can tell us a little bit more about the characters.
1, 2, 3, check out Mars. 1, 2, 3, check out Mars.
I'm a Triceratops all up in this place. Triceratops mean three-horned face. What do I use them for? Scientists debate. Maybe for defense or to find a mate. But I love my horns. Three up on my grill. I'm also really special because I have a frill.
A frill?
Yeah, frill. You heard what I said. It's a plate of bone on top of my head.
Cool. I'm going to be humming that for the rest of my life. That's the Triceratops
the
song.
Raps are very popular. You and know, the outer space raps are also very popular.
A rapid Triceratops. Top that, Michael Crichton. I mean, sorry. Tell us more about some of the characters in StoryBots.
So the characters in StoryBots, they run the gamut. But the StoryBots themselves they're inquisitive little beings that live inside all of our devices. And their job is to help kids and grown-ups answer questions. So the thought was, everybody, wherever there is a screen, whether it's on your phone, whether it's hanging on the wall in your living room, the StoryBots are there and they're ready to lend a hand.
Talk about some of the production process behind StoryBots, because I imagine not only do you have to figure out what subjects and what some of the pedagogical goals are going to be, then you have to build the episode, but you also have to build them to basically work on any device, maybe less on television, but you've got all of these other technical considerations too.
Yeah, I mean, for us, I think it all starts with the idea. And once we say, hey, we're going to do something on outer space, then we have a bunch of, you know, PhDs that we work with in educational psychology. And we'll say, hey, we want to do a hip hop series on outer space. What are five topics that we should do? And then within those, what are the learning points that we have to hit that are critical? What are some extra facts that we can include if there's room? And then they help us sort of build the framework for what we want to tackle. And then we work with like the world's best writers and artists to create stuff that we want to listen to. Like I drive around in my car and I listen to StoryBots songs. It's really, you know, we think it's entertaining.
I want that Triceratops rap. That might end up on my playlist. Evan, how do you deal with different platforms? I mean, there's Netflix, which is kind of the 9 billion pound gorilla in the room right now. There's YouTube, which has created a new kids kind of a walled garden, because YouTube has and still is kind of dealing with criticism over whether or not it properly protects children from inappropriate content. How have you navigated that?
Well, it's actually been a journey. So we started StoryBots in 2012, and you know, we came from the world of short form content, making stuff for the internet. So we started with ABC videos, and the goal was let's put them on YouTube, because that's where there was big audiences, and there was a way to reach them directly. Over time, as we started to have success and realized, wow, people are really responding to StoryBots. My brother and I made the decision to self-fund a TV show. And we said, hey, let's make this and see how it goes. And there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of platforms emerging. Netflix was the clear leader back then. And so we made the show and we talked to Netflix. It went up on Netflix and it was successful. So we worked with them to make another series. And a few years later, Netflix actually recently purchased StoryBots, and we have really big plans about the future for what we're going to be developing there. So StoryBots has found its home. We're in 190 countries around the world. It's been translated into 22 languages. We're really excited about teaching kids around the world in a really fun way. And Netflix has been a great partner for it.
Linda, let me bring you back in terms of different platforms. How do you look at YouTube versus Netflix versus Hulu versus whatever? I mean, PBS has its own platform that it completely controls. The minute you let it outside of that ecosystem, I imagine there are pros and cons that come to play.
Yeah, we just look to work with the right partners for the right shows. We have a relationship with Amazon right now, so a number of our shows run there. There's a PBS Kids Amazon channel through Amazon. You know, we just look for people to work with who get what we're doing and want to show the shows. And as I mentioned earlier, we want to be everywhere that kids are. So, you know, we just, you know, find the right platforms for the right things.
Cindy?
I would also point out that another emerging platform, if you will, is podcasting for kids.
Mm-hmm.
At NSF, we recently funded a new podcast for children called Brains On, and we're doing research because no one really had done much research about, well, wait a minute, how are kids listening to podcasts? Early indications are much of the listening is in the car with their mom and dad or caregiver taking them to school or running errands or going to the soccer game or whatever. But this is yet another platform where children can be exposed to science and in the car have conversations with their parents about the science.
I've heard of Brains On. There's also a podcast called Wow in the World from NPR, which is fantastic. There's a storytelling podcast called Circle Round from WBUR, which I've had the pleasure of reading a story on alongside Sam Sanders, which was a hoot. Meg emailed, I have an 11, 7, and a 3-year-old. My toddler got the whole family hooked on Storybots. I learn something new in every episode, and the songs are so catchy they get stuck in our heads for days. Even my preteen loves it. There's an episode in the most recent season called What Happens When You Flush the Toilet about the sewage system. Long story short, now I have 3 kids who are obsessed with plumbing. Evan, virality, with regards to Meg's email, it seems like one of the goals is to make everything you do a little bit viral.
Yeah, and music has been a big part of that. Also, just for us, like, I think everybody can relate to waking up in the morning and hearing a song, and that song just follows you all day long.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a bit of that. And then also, it's a great way to teach a lesson. If you can put information to music and get it to stick, and you've got that repetitive quality, it's great. And if the music can be good, you know, music that you actually want to listen to, then all the better.
Linda, a question from Grace, who tweeted, it's wonderful how Magic School Bus has inspired kids. My concern is that since TV is so influential in kids' lives, it can also have a negative impact. What about kids with no parental supervision, attracted to shows with negative and dangerous influence?
Right. Well, that will happen, but it won't happen on PBS Kids. So at least we're thinking about that. You know, there's no point where you'd need to worry about your kids. I think that's the issue with YouTube right now, really, is you know, what happens when a kid stumbles out of the walled garden. And we think about that because, you know, we now have PBS Kids channels on YouTube and, you know, we wonder what else happens. So I think that's that all needs to be figured out at this point.
And Sandy, I should ask, as we wrap up, kind of looking forward to the future, what do you wish we saw more of as it relates to educational materials for kids, whether it's television or online or games or mobile or on a legacy platform? What would you like to see more of or maybe less of?
I think just a continuation of building on what we know is some of the best media out there and continuing to push the envelope even further and making sure that children are exposed to what is really best and not, as you just discussed, getting into sites and content that's really can be very inappropriate.
Sandy Welch, Program Director for the National Science Foundation. Sandy, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Joshua.
Linda Semensky is the head of content at PBS Kids. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you, Joshua.
And Evan Spiridellis, the co-founder of JibJab and co-creator of Storybots. Evan, thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
This conversation was produced by Stacia Brown and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about our team, visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.